frantically that it would all go away. The trial was where they had talked of blood and hyoid bones and scrapings from beneath Deb's fingernails, of Deb's sexual activity or lack of it, analysis of when her sister had had sex and how often. Strands of Deb's long black hair had been found in Tim Christopher's back seat, and a discussion had ensued about how exactly a girl's hair might get into her boyfriend's back seat. Was she lying there because they were having intercourse? Or was she lying there because he'd strangled her and she was already dead? Fiona had always thought herself worldly because of her father's career, but the clear forensic debates by strange men in suits in front of a crowded courtroom of the contents of Deb's vagina, no one had ever said the word vagina in their house, had shocked her deeply, sickeningly. She had looked around the room and known that every person there was picturing smart, sleek, handsome Tim Christopher atop her sister in his back seat, grunting away. That right there had been the first clear understanding that adulthood was going to be nothing like she'd thought it would be. There had been testimony one day from one of Tim Christopher's college friends. He had seen Tim the morning of the murder. They had shot hoops between classes. They had talked about nothing special, the friend recalled, except for one thing. There had been mention of a girl they both knew who had unsuccessfully tried to commit suicide the week before. The friend had been shocked, but Tim Christopher had just shrugged, throwing the ball at the hoop. "Some girls should just be dead," the friend remembered Tim saying, his voice cold. "There's nothing that can be done." Deb, dead in that cold field. Sonia Gallipo, curled up in the well 400 feet away. Some girls should just be dead. Fiona thought of her sister's long, beautiful black hair and closed her eyes. Chapter 10 Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. It snowed overnight, just a light dusting that gathered in the cracks and crevices, blowing in the wind like packing peanuts. Fiona drove over roads more and more remote and rutted into East Mills, a tiny town that didn't seem to offer much more than a gas station, a few grimy shops, and a Dunkin' Donuts. Trucks blasted by as she traveled the main street, either on their way to Canada or on their way back. The sky was mottled, the sun coming and going behind swift-moving clouds. Sarah London lived in an old Victorian with missing shingles and a postage stamp front lawn that was thick with dead weeds. Fiona had tried to call first, but had gotten only a phone that rang and rang on the other end, with no answering machine, and she hadn't had a signal on her cell at all for the last half hour. She pulled the phone out of her pocket now as she sat in the driveway, but saw that she had no bars. Fine, then. She would wing it. She got out and walked to the wooden porch, her boots loud on the damp, sagging steps. According to the DMV record Jamie had pulled, Sarah London was 88 years old, which made the house's neglect logical, especially if the old woman lived alone. Her first knock on the storm door wasn't answered, but her second knock brought a faint shuffling from within. "Miss London?" she called. "I'm not a salesperson. My name is Fiona Sheridan, and I'm a journalist." That brought footsteps, as she'd known it would. The inner door swung open to reveal a woman with a stooped back, her thin white hair tied back. Though her posture was crouched and she was wearing an old housecoat, she still gave off an air of offended dignity. She narrowed her eyes at Fiona through the screen. "What does a journalist want with me?" "I'm doing a story on Idlewild Hall." In an instant, the woman's eyes lit up, a reaction that she quickly struggled to mask as if she thought Fiona was leading her on. "No one cares about Idlewild Hall," she said, suspicious again.
"I do," Fiona said. "They're restoring it. Did you know that?"
For a second the woman swayed in utter surprise, her gaze so vacant with shock that Fiona wondered if she'd have to barge inside and use the landline to call 911. Then she gripped the doorframe and unlatched the storm door.
My God, my God, she murmured. Come inside.
The house's interior mirrored the exterior, a place that had been cared for but was now sinking into neglect with the age of its owner. An unused sitting room sat primly on the right, old figurines and knick-knacks growing dust on its fussy shelves. The floor of the front hall was lined with a plastic runner that had probably been placed there in the late 80s. Fiona politely paused and unlaced her boots as the woman proceeded into the kitchen.
I don't have anything,
the woman said as she looked around the kitchen where the newspaper she'd been reading was neatly set on the kitchen table.
I wasn't expecting.
It's okay, Miss London, Fiona said. I don't need anything. Thank you.
What did you say your name was again?
Fiona Sheridan. Call me Fiona, please. Sarah London nodded, and Fiona noticed she didn't return the invitation.
Have a seat, Fiona.
Obediently, Fiona pulled out a kitchen chair and sat on it. Once a teacher, always a teacher, she thought. She folded her hands in front of her on the table. That seemed to please the old woman. She pulled out her own chair and lowered herself. Her hands were twisted and gnarled with arthritis, the knuckles pearly gray.
Now please tell me about this restoration. As you can see, I've been reading the newspaper, which I do every day. I've never read anything about this.
That's why I'm writing the story, Fiona said. Miss London seemed to consider this.
Who in the world is mad enough to restore Idlewild?
It was a sentiment that so closely mirrored Fiona's own thoughts that she paused. But there was a tinge of nerves on the edges of Miss London's expression, on the edges of her words. A woman named Margaret Eden, she said, aided by her son, Anthony. Miss London blinked and shook her head.
I've never heard of such people.
Fiona had a list of questions in her head that she'd planned to ask, but on an impulse, she skipped all of them. Why do you think it's mad to restore Idlewild? She said.
Well, of course it's mad.
Miss London's voice shook a little, but she maintained her composure, sitting with ramrod posture.
Of course it is. That old building, that old place.
She waved a twisted hand as if Fiona should surely know what she was talking about.
Are they making it into a school?
Yes.
Oh, dear God.
The words were spoken swiftly, softly, as if they'd escaped from the woman's mouth. Then she recovered and said,
Well, I wish them luck.
You were a teacher there for a long time, were you not?
29 years, until the school's last day.
You must have loved it there.
No one loved it there,
the older woman said bluntly.
Those girls were trouble. They made life miserable for all of us. They weren't good girls, not at all.
Fiona felt her eyebrows rise. And yet you stayed.
Teaching is all I know, Fiona,
Miss London said, her expression growing stern.
It's what I do, or what I did, at least.
Was Idlewild the only place you ever worked?
I worked at a few other schools after Idlewild closed until I retired. I'm local.
That hand wave again, as if there was no need to say all of this aloud.
Born not even half a mile from where we're sitting now, a Vermonter all my life. I never saw the need to leave.
In the pasty light of the kitchen, Sarah London looked much older than she had at first, her eyes watery, the corners of her mouth drooping. She was a tough old Vermonter, but that didn't mean she'd had an easy life. I have a photograph, Fiona said. Would you like to see it?
I suppose,
Miss London said carefully, though the gleam of interest in her eyes was a dead giveaway. Fiona pulled a printout of the field hockey photograph from her pocket and smoothed it out over the table. Miss London looked at it for a long time.
That's me, she said finally. Took over the team the year Charlene McMaster quit to get married. She barely lasted 8 months. I didn't want to do it, not one bit. But we did as we were told in those days.
Do you remember these girls? Fiona asked.
Of course I do. We didn't have all that many students, and my memory hasn't gone yet, praise God.
Fiona glanced down at the photograph, the girls lined up in their uniforms. They weren't good girls. You even remember their names?
Yes, probably. Why do you ask?
This was taken 2 years after the disappearance of a student named Sonia Gallipo, Fiona said. Do you remember that? The room rang with deafening silence. Miss London? Fiona asked.
The French girl,
Miss London said quietly, almost to herself. She shook her head.
I haven't heard that name in over 60 years.
Something happened to her, Fiona said. In 1950.
She ran away, they said.
Miss London's hand went to her face, the gnarled yet elegant old fingers stroking her cheek in an absent, thoughtful gesture.
I remember that day, my first year. She went off to see relatives and never came back.
What do you remember? Fiona prompted softly.
Everything.
Miss London's fingers stroked her cheek again, automatic.
We searched for her, but not for long. There wasn't much to do about a runaway girl. I never said anything because the case was closed and we all moved on. But I always thought she was dead.
Why did you think she was dead? Fiona asked.
Don't get me wrong. We had girls who ran away.
Miss London shook her head.
One just the year before Sonia. There's nothing you can do about a bad apple. But I never thought Sonia would do it. She had nowhere to go, for one. She wasn't even American. She was plain, quiet as a mouse. She wouldn't go off hitching rides or running away with some boy. She didn't have it in her.
So you don't think she ran away?
I thought at first. The relatives must have done it. It's the obvious choice, isn't it? No one knew them. They came to see her once a year at Christmas, but that was all. Then she goes to visit, and she never comes back. But they checked out the relatives and said no, they were just a couple of old people who felt sorry for her, but didn't want to take in a girl. The wife had nagged the husband into the visit, said she felt bad leaving the girl there for so long, with a visit only once a year. The husband didn't want to do it. He wasn't interested in a teenage girl, though eventually he gave in. But she'd changed her bus ticket and run away from them, too.
Fiona waited. Miss London's eyes were open, but she was seeing nothing. Nothing but 1950. There wasn't even a clock ticking in this house. It was so silent.
They found her suitcase, Miss London continued. In the woods, right off the edge of Old Barron's Road, where it meets the school gates. They found it in the weeds.
Now it was Fiona's turn to freeze in shock. Right where I was walking, she thought. Right where I was standing, talking to Jamie on the phone and listening to a shuffling sound in the gravel that was just like a footstep. The old teacher kept talking, the words spilling out.
What girl runs away with no suitcase, I ask you? Her friends were beside themselves, but the Winthrop girl left a few years later, and that girl, the Ellesmere's girl, left after that. I don't know what happened to them. I don't know what happened to any of them.
Wait a minute, Fiona said. They found her abandoned suitcase, and still everyone thought she'd run away?
You weren't there, Miss London argued. You weren't living with those girls, in that place. We had a girl run away the year before I came. They'd thought for sure she was dead. Then she turned up at her grandparents in Florida with some hoodlum in tow.
Her eyes met Fiona's,
eyes that were aged and watery, but somehow hard. Sonia ran away from her own relatives, so it was decided. I couldn't say anything. I was new. But even then I understood.
Understood what?
You can sit there and judge. But you spent 29 years at Idlewild. I was on edge every day. It's a hard place, an awful place. I had to stay because it was my job, because I needed the money. But sometimes the girls, they ran. And deep down, we didn't blame them.
Why not?
Because we were all so horribly afraid.
The back of Fiona's neck was icy cold.
Afraid of what?
Miss London's lips parted, but there was a smack on the front storm door, followed by the bang of the inner door.
Aunt Sari?
Came a woman's voice, roughened by cigarette smoke.
It's me.
Shoes clomped up the hallway runner, and Fiona twisted in her chair to see a woman in her late 40s come to the kitchen door, her lank, blonde hair in a ponytail, her wide hips pressed into yoga pants beneath her parka. She was scowling.
Oh, hello, she said, her voice darkening with suspicion.
Fiona pushed her chair back and stood up, figuring she was once again being mistaken for a salesperson, probably in the midst of snowing an 88-year-old woman into some kind of scam.
I'm Fiona Sheridan, she said, holding out her hand. I'm a journalist writing a story about Idlewild Hall.
The cloud left the woman's face, and she looked at Miss London for confirmation.
Okay, then, she said ungraciously, shaking Fiona's hand briskly in her freezing cold one. I saw your car outside. Aunt Sari almost never has visitors.
Kathy's my sister's daughter, Miss London said from her seat at the table. She had recovered her brisk teacher's manner.
Fiona's chance was gone. There was no way to get back what had just been about to be said, whatever that was. But she wasn't ready to leave yet, Kathy or no Kathy.
Miss London, I'll get out of your hair, but can I ask you a few quick questions first? Nothing too complicated, I promise.
Miss London nodded, and Kathy banged into the kitchen, noisily doing something with the dishes in the sink. I'm watching you, her every movement said. Fiona quickly lowered herself into a chair again.
First of all, the records from Idlewild haven't been located. Do you remember anything about where they might have gone when the school closed?
I don't know anything about any records, the old woman said,
as Kathy banged a glass especially loud on the counter behind her.
Okay, Fiona said. You mentioned Sonia's friends. Can you tell me anything else about them?
Those girls were her roommates in Clayton Hall, the dorm, came the answer, called straight up from the old woman's memory. They were together often. It was hard for her to make friends, I suppose, since she was quiet and not pretty. I remember thinking it was unusual to see girls like that become friends. They didn't fit.
Didn't fit? How?
Oh, Lord.
She waved a hand again, and Kathy ran the water in the sink in a rushing jet, nearly drowning her out.
The Winthrop girl, for one. She was trouble through and through. She was a bad influence. The Green girl was nice enough, but we all knew she'd had a mental breakdown at home and stopped talking for months. Quiet, but touched in the head, that one. The Ellesmere girl came from a good family, but not properly, if you know what I mean. She was stupid, too. Not like Sonia.
Fiona pulled her notebook and pen from her pocket, the first time she'd done so.
What were their names, their full names, starting with the Winthrop girl?
It was a long time ago, Kathy complained from the sink. Aunt Sari shouldn't have to remember names. I do, Miss London insisted, her teacher's voice so icy that Kathy was immediately silenced. The Winthrop girl's name was Katie. Her people were from Connecticut, I think. Good people, though their daughter had gone bad.
She was a discipline problem from the day she arrived until the day she left.
Where did she go? Home?
No. God knows. I think she found a boy or something. It wouldn't surprise me. She had that kind of look. The kind that boys go crazy for. Beauty, but not the wholesome kind.
She shook her head.
The one that was touched in the head was Roberta Green. She was on the field hockey team.
She pulled the photo printout toward her and stabbed a finger at one of the girls.
That's her right there.
Fiona nodded, trying not to show how excited she was. Roberta Green was the girl she and Jamie thought might have become a lawyer. She couldn't have been too touched in the head to get through law school and pass the bar. She had a breakdown, you say? Maybe there were medical records somewhere.
Stop talking. There was a suicide in the family, I believe, or an attempted one, and she witnessed it.
That's terrible. Miss London shrugged.
We didn't have social services or child psychologists in those days. We didn't have Oprah or Dr. Phil. Parents just didn't know what to do. They were at the end of their rope, and they sent her to us.
Okay. Fiona steered the old woman's memories back. The last girl, the stupid one, you said her name was Ellesmere? Behind her, Kathy finally gave up and stood watching them, her arms crossed tightly over her chest. Miss London answered,
"The Ellesmeres were a prominent family in those days. The girl, Cecilia was her name, I have it now, was the daughter of Brad Ellesmere, but born on the wrong side of the blanket, if you know what I mean."
"Right." Fiona caught Kathy's eye, and they exchanged a brief look. The generation of people who used phrases like born on the wrong side of the blanket was rapidly disappearing, Fiona thought with a pang. So she was Mr. Ellesmere's child, but she didn't have his name.
That's right.
Miss London lowered her voice a little, as if someone could still overhear this bit of juicy gossip.
She was the housekeeper's daughter. He let her have the child, but he packed her away. There was something about the mother going away for a while, too. Went crazy from having a child out of wedlock, or so I heard. Brad Ellesmere didn't have children inside his marriage, but he had more than one bastard child. It was a scandal in those days, but we kept quiet about it. It was private business. It wasn't like now, when everybody's business is all over the Internet, for the world to see.
Fiona wrote down the name Cecilia. "And what was her last name, then?" she asked. "Her legal one."
"Oh, goodness."
Miss London stroked her cheek again, but this time it was for show. She was having a good time, and she wanted to draw it out. Fiona waited patiently, her pen poised.
"We all thought of her as the Ellesmere girl. There was no secret about it. Brad Ellesmere himself dropped her off at the school. She used to follow the Winthrop girl around. It was a natural pairing, the strong, pretty girl with the weaker, pudgier one. Ah, yes, Frank. That was her last name. I told you there was nothing wrong with my memory."
"No," Fiona smiled at her. "There certainly isn't." "Okay, Aunt Sari," Kathy broke in. "You need a rest." "Thank you very much for your help, Miss London," Fiona said.
"You're welcome. What does Sonia Gallipo have to do with a story on the school's restoration?"
"Part of the article is about some of the newsworthy events in the school's past," Fiona said smoothly. "Sonia's disappearance is one of them. I thought that if I could track down a few of her friends, one of them might be able to give me a memory of her."
"You're going to have a tangle," Miss London said, practically. "Most of the girls disappeared when they left school. No one knew where they went, and frankly, there was no one who cared."
There was a second of silence in the room as these harsh words came down. Then Kathy moved to the kitchen door. "Don't get up, Aunt Sari. Fiona,
I'll show you out.
Fiona followed her through the house's stuffy hall. At the front door, she put her boots back on and dug a business card out of her pocket, putting it in Kathy's hand. I appreciate you letting me talk to her, she said. If she remembers anything else, or if I can come back and see her again, please give me a call.
Kathy gave her a baleful, suspicious stare, but took the card.
No one cares about Aunt Sari anymore, she said. No one ever has. She's a good woman. If you publish one bad word about her, I'll come find you and sue you. It was as good a farewell as she was going to get, so Fiona took it. As she started her car and pulled out of the driveway, she wondered why Sarah London's niece felt it was so important to insist, after all these years, that her aunt was a good woman. She was 5 miles out of East Mills before she got a cell signal again, her phone beeping and vibrating on the passenger seat. She was on a back road heading to the paved two-lane that would eventually turn into Seven Points Road, her car shuddering over old potholes, but she pulled over beneath an overhang of trees and picked up the phone. In these parts, it was always best to take advantage of a signal when you could get one. There was a message from Jamie. Call me. She dialed him first, bypassing his office line and using his personal cell. He picked up on the second ring.
Where are you?
He asked. Heading back from East Mills. I talked to the teacher.
And?
I got a few names of Sonia's friends. I'll start tracking them. What about you? There was disappointment in his voice. There was a low murmur of voices in the background, and she guessed he was inside the station, in the open desk area the cops used.
I have nothing, if you can believe it.
Nothing?
The French police came back to me. They have a birth record of Sonia Galipo in 1935, and that's all. Nothing else.
Fiona felt her heart sink. She thought of the girl's body, curled in on itself in the well, her head resting on her knees. No living relatives at all?
None. There's a death record for her father in Dachau concentration camp in 1943. Nothing about her mother or any siblings.
Fiona stared out her windshield at a swirl of snow that had kicked up on the side of the road in the wind. Those words, Dachau concentration camp, had the power to give her a twist of nausea, a clammy, greasy chill of fear. I thought the Nazis kept records of everything.
So did I, but I think we're wrong. It's like Sonia was born and then she and her mother disappeared off the face of the earth, until Sonia appeared on the immigration records, alone.
It was hard for her to make friends, Sarah London had said of Sonia, since she was quiet and not pretty. What sort of life had Sonia lived, the lone survivor of her small family in a strange country? Fiona felt outraged that she had died alone, her head smashed in, dumped in a well for 64 years. Deb had died alone, but she'd been found within 30 hours, buried with love at a funeral that had drawn hundreds of friends and family. She'd been grieved for 20 years, loved, was still grieved. Sonia had simply been forgotten. I guess we need to find the friends then, she said to Jamie. Miss London said the girls were roommates and that they were close. One of them must remember her.
I agree, Jamie said. Listen, I have to go. Give me the names, will you?
For a second, Fiona felt the urge to say no. She wanted to do this. She wanted to be the one to track these girls down, to talk to them, to do something for the dead girl in the well. But she couldn't do as much on her own as she could with the Baron's police force helping her. So she gave Jamie the names and hung up, staring at the deserted roadside with her phone in her lap, wondering why she felt like she'd just given the case away, let it slip from her hands. She called her father, and the second she heard his voice, she began to feel better. Dad, can I come by?
Fee! Yes, of course.
She heard the rustle of papers, the beep of the outdated computer. He was working, as always.
How far are you? Let me put tea on.
Give me 25 minutes.
You have something to run by me, don't you, my girl?
Yes, I do.
That's my daughter, he said, and hung up.
The trees waved in the wind, the bare branches overhanging the car wafting like a sultan's fan. Fiona shivered and sank farther into her coat, unwilling to move for the moment. She had done this the other night, too, sat in her parked car at the side of the road, staring at nothing and thinking. There was something soothing and meditative about the side of a road, a place most people passed by. As a child, she'd spent car rides looking out the window, thinking of the places they passed, wondering what it would be like to stop there, or there, or there. It had never been enough for her just to get from one place to another. Now she watched as a crow landed on a stark branch on the other side of the road, its big black body gleaming as if coated with oil. It cocked its black beak at her and was soon joined by a second bird, the two of them edging cautiously along the branch the way birds do, each foot rising and falling with careful precision, the talons flexing out and curling in again as they gripped the branch. They stared at her with their small black eyes, so fathomless, yet so knowing, as if they were taking in every detail of her. Near the end of the branch, having found a good vantage point, both birds were still. The phone shrilled and vibrated in Fiona's lap, making her jump. She didn't recognize the number, but it was local. She answered, "Hello?"
"Okay, fine."
The words were brisk, not bothering with a greeting. Fiona recognized the voice only because she'd just heard it 20 minutes ago. It was Kathy.
"Aunt Sari's napping, and she can't hear me, so I guess I'll tell you. But you have to promise she won't get in trouble."
Fiona felt her heart stutter in her chest, the back of her neck prickling. "What do you mean, get in trouble?"
"She had good intentions," Kathy said. "You have to understand that Aunt Sari has a good heart. She meant well. She's been paranoid ever since she did it. That's why she didn't tell you. But she's getting old now, and we're going to get rid of the house soon. She's moving in with me. We might as well tell you as anyone."
"Kathy," Fiona was sitting up in the driver's seat now, her mouth dry. "What are you talking about?"
"The records," Kathy said. "From the school. She took them, the last day. They were going to destroy them. 60 years of records. There was nowhere to put them, nowhere to store them. No one wanted them. The Christophers had bought the land and were going to put the records in the landfill. So Aunt Sari volunteered to take the records to the dump. But instead, she brought them home."
"Home?"
"In the shed out back," Kathy said. "They're all there. They've been there since 1979. We'll have to get rid of them when we sell the house. Give me a few days to talk Aunt Sari into it, and you can come and get them. Hell, they're worthless. You can have every single one of them for all I care."
Chapter 11. Katie. Barrons, Vermont, October 1950. Katie had never been to special detention before, not even when she got into a fist fight with Charlotte Kankel. That fight had been broken up by Sally D'Alessandro, the dorm monitor for Floor 3, before she'd left Idlewild and nosy Susan Brady had been appointed instead. Sally had had an oddly languid manner for a dorm monitor, and she'd never sent anyone to special detention. She'd just half-heartedly dressed them down as she'd stood in front of them with her droopy posture and bony arms.
"Hey, just stop it, okay?"
Katie followed Mrs. Peabody across the courtyard, her hands still jittering in nervous fear. What had just happened? Had that been real? The door banging open? The voice? She hadn't heard the words exactly, but she'd heard something. High-pitched, plaintive. The other girls had looked as scared as she was. Katie watched Mrs. Peabody's polyester-clad back, looking for a sign, a reaction, anything from a grown-up. All she saw was the teacher's furiously angry stride, the swish of her dress loud in the silence. Mrs. Peabody led her to a room on the first floor at the end of the teacher's dorm. She pointed to a stack of Latin textbooks, accompanied by a blank paper and a pen.
"The conjugation exercises," she said succinctly. "Do them until the detention is finished. I'll be checking your work."
Katie stared balefully at the stack of books. "The exercises from which one?" she asked.
"All of them,"
Mrs. Peabody replied. Think twice before you talk back to me, and you pull a prank like that again.
It wasn't a prank, Katie protested. How was that even possible? How could she have made the door slam open?
But in an angry flash of understanding, she knew it didn't matter, because Mrs. Peabody already knew. This was all a fiction to make the teacher feel better.
It was Mary, she said to the older woman, the truth hard and satisfying as she watched Mrs. Peabody recoil. It was Mary.
Mrs. Peabody lunged forward and grabbed Katie's arm so fast, so hard, that Katie cried out.
I will hear no more of this nonsense, she hissed,
her face so close Katie could smell sugary peppermint on her breath. Her eyes were hard with fear. She shook Katie once, her fingers digging into her arm.
Conjugation exercises. 1 hour.
She let her go and left, shutting the door with a click.
It wasn't a prank,
Katie screamed at the closed door as loud as she could.
It was Mary.
There was no response. Stupid. Stupid. She was still shaking. Time to get herself together. Katie did a circuit of the room. A dusty chalkboard, a grimy window looking out toward the woods, a stack of old local newspapers, mostly rotted, a single desk and chair, the desk stacked with the books, papers, and pen. Katie tried the door. It was locked. She yanked at the window, but got a shower of old paint flakes in her hair for the effort. She got on her stockinged knees and inspected the desk, looking at all the initials carved by girls locked in special detention over the years. Disappointing. She didn't recognize any of the initials, nor had anyone carved anything good into the hard wood. A riffle through the blank notepaper showed nothing there, either. Then she looked at the stack of textbooks, books that stayed permanently in this room. Teachers are so stupid. She sat in the hard ladder-backed chair and leafed open the top book. The verb conjugation answers were written in the margins. Doing the exercises would be easy. The book was full of other messages left over the years, including an entire story about a unicorn written in pencil over the empty back pages, complete with drawings. The story started innocently and got progressively dirtier until the final illustration was so rude even Katie had to laugh. Whoever the author was, the story was unsigned, Katie approved of her heartily. There were other messages in the book's margins, some of them barely literate, some of them rude, some of them potentially useful. Mrs. Patton pretends she has a husband, but she doesn't. Interesting. Mrs. Patton was Idlewild's headmistress, often spoken of but rarely seen. Katie filed this tidbit away. Mary Hand walks on Old Barron's Road at night. She sucks blood. Maybe true, probably not, and not very interesting either way. There is a baby buried in the garden. Katie had heard this one before. It was one of Idlewild's myths, though she had no idea if it was true. Everyone hated the garden, which they were all forced to use in weekly sessions called weekly gardening. There was no one reason the garden was so hated, though the strangely slimy soil and the pervasive chill created by the shadows of the two buildings that bordered it were part of it. The garden never drained properly, and it always had an odor of rotting vegetables to it, mixed with something more pungent. Every once in a while, someone resurrected the dead baby story, probably to scare the freshman girls. Katie looked up when she noticed movement on the wall. A spider was crawling down from the ceiling, its legs rippling gracefully, its body fat and black. Katie stared at it for a long minute, transfixed and shuddering. Idlewild had a lot of spiders, and mice, and beetles, and bats under the eaves outside the locker rooms. But the spiders were the worst. If she killed it with her shoe, she'd be stuck looking at its dead black smear for the rest of special detention. Reluctantly, she looked down at the books again. The next textbook had other bits of wisdom. If you call for Mary Hand at dusk under a new moon, she rises from the grave. Beneath this, a different girl had written in bold black pen, "Tried it, not true." The conversation was continued by a third girl, writing along the bottom of the page. "She is real. Died in 1907 after miscarriage. It is in the records." A debater chimed in. "Idlewild was not opened until 1919, stupid." To which was returned, "This house was here then. Look it up. Her baby is buried in the garden." The baby in the garden again. Katie glanced up at the spider, which was halfway down the wall now, intent on its spider business. There was a second one in the far corner of the ceiling, still and curled. She could not see a web. "Maybe I should kill them after all," she thought. Feeling like she was being watched, she forced her gaze down and reached forward to turn the page. "Hold still," a voice said in her ear as a spider, black and cold, crawled over the edge of the desk and skittered over the back of her hand. Katie screamed, upending the chair and backing away, shaking her hand. The spider dropped out of sight, but she could still feel the touch of its tiny legs on her skin, the feather pokes of its feet. Her heart was pounding so hard her vision blurred, and she heard deep, gasping breathing that she realized was her own. She put her hands to her ears. "Hold still," the voice said again. Her teeth chattered. She struggled to inhale a breath that tasted like old chalk and something acid, sour. She backed up against the wall, her shoulders bumping it, then too late remembered the spider she'd seen. She looked up to find it poised several feet above her left ear, utterly still, clearly watching her. It began a slow, deliberate pace toward her, somehow intent. The other spider was still in the corner of the ceiling, curled, though its legs were now waving helplessly, as if it couldn't move. Katie tried the locked door again, her clammy hand slipping on the knob. Then she lunged to the desk, picked up one of the textbooks, and smashed the spider on the wall. She couldn't look at the mess it made. She dropped the textbook and picked up the next one, holding it up, maneuvering back toward the door. Somehow the door seemed the safest place. Her hands were shaking. She nearly put her back to the door, then realized there could be more spiders. Spiders! And stood several inches from it instead, the textbook under her arm. The silence beat in her ears. There was no movement. "Fuck!" she said into the silence. It was an awful word, the worst curse she knew, the worst word in her entire vocabulary. Her mother would have slapped her if she'd heard her speak it. It felt good, somehow powerful, coming from her mouth right now. "Fuck!" she said again, louder. "Fuck!" There was no answer. She spun in a circle, still keyed up and shaking, the textbook raised, her gaze skipping over the disgusting smear on the wall. Everything was still. The thing in the top corner had stopped moving. She let out a shaky breath. There were cold tears on her cheeks, she realized, though she had no memory of shedding them. She looked down at the textbook in her hands and opened it. Written in pencil, the lines of a familiar rhyme looked back up at her. Mary Hand, dead and buried under land. She'll say she wants to be your friend. Do not let her in again. She stared at it, her head aching, her eyes burned. Those two words, "hold still." She wanted to cry again. She'd met Thomas when she was 13. He was 16, with big, heavy shoulders, eyes that drooped sleepily, and a curious smell of mothballs. He'd lived on the other side of the block. He'd liked to flirt with her, and she'd loved the attention, tickling, chasing, wrestling, more tickling. He had given her silly nicknames, teased her, made fun of her. She'd played along, breathless, feeling special, singled out among the other girls. He was 16. And then, an afternoon in July, the air hot, the sky high and blistering blue, the two of them in the empty schoolyard, chasing each other around the playground, abandoned in the summer heat. He'd caught her behind the slide, which was too hot to touch that day, the slide that was so familiar to her, with its nonsensical words painted down the side, "Big Slide Fun." Thomas had pinned her to the ground, shoved at her skirt. "Hold still," he'd said. He'd knocked the wind out of her, and for a second her eyes focused on those bright yellow words, "Big Slide Fun," in confusion, the letters crossing over one another. Then she'd felt his fingers on her, and she'd fought him. She'd bitten him, scratched him, thrashed him with her feet. He'd hit her, and thumped her to her knees on the ground when she'd tried to run, his big hands on her, his mothball smell in her nose. "Hold still," yanking her cotton underpants off, his only words to her for those few frantic, hot minutes, "Hold still." She'd managed to run. She wasn't faster than he was, with his big, long legs, but he gave up quickly, not wanting to chase her publicly through the neighborhood. She remembered coming through the front door of her house and seeing herself in the eyes of her mother, who was just then coming down the stairs. Disheveled, her stockings ripped, her underwear gone, dirt in her hair, blood on her knees, a red mark on her cheek. Her mother had stared at her in shock for a moment and descended the rest of the stairs in one quick motion, gripping Katie by the arm.
"For God's sake, get cleaned up," she'd said. "Do you want your father to see you like this?"
"I don't..."
"Katie!"
Her mother's grip was painful. She was wearing a flowered silk blouse and a dark green skirt, stockings, heels. Katie could smell her mother's familiar smell, the Calgon soap she used, and the Severin's ladies' pomade she used in her hair. She could see the familiar look in her mother's eyes, anger, wretched fear, bone-deep disgust. "You're going to get in trouble," her mother had warned her countless times, hissed angrily when her father was out of range, when she'd tried to run away yet again. "I don't know what's the matter with you. I've never known. You're going to get in trouble."
"Go,"
her mother said, shoving her toward the stairs. They blamed her, of course. They never even asked who the boy was, not that she would have told them. The low, murmured conversations behind closed doors were almost expected after that. Katie thought about running away again, but instead she'd been dropped off at Idlewild 3 weeks later, the mark on her cheek faded, the scrapes on her knees healed. The special detention room was still. The air was thin, stale. The spider in the corner had quieted, but Katie was not fooled. Somewhere here, breathing, a quiet sound, somewhere she couldn't see. And then, a breath of voice, pleading, "Let me in." Katie felt her legs tense. She squeezed her bladder, trying not to let it go. "Let me in." More clear now, coming from the direction of the window. "Please, please, I'm so cold. Let me in."
"No,"
Katie said. She made herself shout it.
"No, I'm not letting you in. Go away. Please."
The voice was high, pitiful, pleading.
"I'll die out here."
Katie was shaking.
"You can't, because you're already dead."
She stared at the window, saw nothing, and turned in a full circle, her eyes panicked and staring.
"I'm not letting you in, so go away. I mean it."
"Let me in," came the plaintive cry again. And then her mother's voice, close to Katie's ear, spoken like an expert mimic. "You're going to get in trouble." She exhaled a long, terrified breath. She waited. But no more voices came, not for the moment. But they would come again. She already knew she was going to be in here for a while. She stepped to the desk, picking up the pen and tapping it experimentally, looking for hidden spiders. Then she retreated to her spot next to the door. She balanced the textbook on her other arm and managed to write with cold, stiff fingers. I am trapped in special detention with Mary Hand, and I can't get out. She stilled for a long moment, waiting. Waiting. Then she added, Mary knows. She lowered herself to the floor and crossed her legs beneath her skirt as something faint and weak scrabbled at the window. Chapter 12. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Malcolm Sheridan listened patiently, sipping his tea, as Fiona told him about the girl in the well. As she talked, he got quietly excited, evidenced by the quick jittering of his knee.
"Does the coroner have her?"
he asked when she finished. He meant the body. Sonia's body. "Yes."
"That'll be Dave Saunders. Can you get the results through Jamie? If not, I can call him."
Fiona sat back in her mother's old flowered chair, thinking. "I don't think the report will have any surprises," she said. "I saw the girl. Her skull was clearly smashed in. I can probably get the report from Jamie."
"That's a damned lucky break with those records," her father said, his mind already flying past hers, following its own track.
He had put down his cup and was staring at the glass coffee table, his brow furrowing. This was what he was like when a story was brewing, she thought. She hadn't seen this in a long time. "What I want," she said, trying to steer his formidable brain, "is to know if there's something we're missing in France. Family, history, something more than a birth certificate."
"You mean something from the camps," Malcolm said.
"Yes. Jamie found her birth record, but..."
"No, no, no," Malcolm interrupted. He got out of his chair and started to pace. "There are other places to look. Libraries, museums, archives. The government record is the smallest part of the picture. Was she a Jew?"
Fiona shook her head. "I don't know."
"It's possible she wasn't. She would have been so young during the war. Not all the camps took children, or kept them alive if they did. If her father was in Dachau, she was likely imprisoned with her mother. We'll have a better chance of finding her through a search for the mother."
Fiona looked at her notes. "The mother's name was Emily. Emily Gallipo."
"But no death record?"
Malcolm picked up his cup and carried it into the kitchen. His voice traveled back to her.
"It could have been any of the camps. Ravensbrück took women, and children too, I think. So many of the records were sealed for decades, but a lot of them are coming unsealed now. And, of course, many records were completely lost. The war was a great mess of data, you know, before computers. Full of human hubris and error. A different time. I have reference books, but some of them are outdated already. In some ways, right now is an exciting time for historians, if you can catch the last survivors before they die."
"Okay," Fiona said. A pulse of excitement beat in her throat, but she tried to push it down. Most goose chases like this ended up with nothing, she reminded herself. "Since I can't go to France and search every archive and library, what do I do?" Her father reappeared in the doorway, his eyes crinkled with amusement.
"You talk to someone who can, or who already is."
"The police..."
"Fee, fee."
He was clearly laughing at her now.
"You've spent too long with that policeman of yours. The police don't have all the answers, and neither does the government. The people are where you find things, like those records you just found. The people are the ones who keep the memories and the records the powers that be would rather erase."
"Dad." If she didn't stop him now, he'd launch over his favorite ground, the political lectures that used to amuse her mother before Deb died. Once a hippie, always a hippie. "Okay, okay. We can go through whatever channels you want to find information. I promised Jamie we wouldn't interfere with the police investigation. That's all.
No, the police will do an autopsy, do a search for living relatives, then put the file in a cold case box and move on. They won't be going anywhere near France in 1945. But we can find her feet. We can find out who she was.
For a second, emotion rolled up through Fiona's throat and she couldn't breathe. Her father had been like this once upon a time. The man in the photo on the wall in the other room, the man on the ground in Vietnam in 1969, had been complicated and demanding and often absent, but he had been so painfully, vibrantly alive it had almost hurt to be around him. The air had crackled when he walked into a room. Malcolm Sheridan had never done small talk. He was the kind of man who looked you in the eye on first meeting and said, "Do you enjoy what you do? Do you find it fulfilling?" If you had the courage to answer, he'd listen like it was the most fascinating thing he'd ever heard. And in that moment, it always was. He was a brilliant dreamer, a relentless intellectual, and a troublemaker. But the thing that always struck you about Fiona's father was that he was truly interested in everything. It had been 20 years since she'd seen that man. He'd vanished when Deb's body had been found on the field at Idlewild. When Tim Christopher had murdered his daughter, Malcolm had folded in on himself, disappeared. The man who had emerged from that experience had been subdued, unfocused, his anger scattershot, bubbling up and disappearing into apathy again. Fiona's mother, who had been so tolerant of his larger-than-life personality before the murder, had simply shut down. She'd severed herself from his interests, from their friends. After the divorce, she'd been determined not to be that woman, Malcolm's wife, Deb's mother, anymore. But this Malcolm, the one Fiona was seeing a shadowy glimpse of right now, this Malcolm was the man people still spoke reverently of 20 years later, the man people still dropped everything for when he phoned, the man who had inspired such awe that his name had still gotten Fiona hired at Lively Vermont. But she couldn't say any of that. They never talked about it, about what had happened after Deb. It was too hard. Fiona gathered up her notes, trying to keep her expression and her voice level.
"Okay," she said to him. "I'll leave it with you. I have to stop by Lively Vermont, and I'm going to find these girls, these school friends of Sonia's."
"I'll call you later," he said, turning back toward the kitchen. He called out, "Make sure that boy of yours doesn't screw up the investigation."
As Fiona was on the road to the Lively Vermont offices, her phone buzzed. Anthony Eden. She ignored it. She'd update him later. Starving, she stopped for a burrito, then drove through downtown Barron's to the boxy old low-rise whose cheap rent was the kind that Lively Vermont could afford. Though it was only 5 o'clock, the sun was sinking fast in the sky, reminding her that winter in its full force was coming with its whiteouts and snowdrifts. She was too late to see Jonas. He must have left on time today, which was rare for him. Fiona got the janitor to let her in. The offices were empty, Jonas's door closed and locked. Instead of bothering him at home, Fiona took a piece of scrap paper from a handy desk and wrote, "Came by to give you an update. Not much yet, but it's good. Trust me. I'll call tomorrow. F." She folded the paper and slipped it under his door. She'd had the file she'd pulled from the archives under her arm, so she walked to the scarred old cabinets on the wall to replace it. But with the drawer open and the file in her hand, she paused. "There are references to the Christophers in there," Jonas had warned her. He was right. She'd seen it when she read the file, a photograph from the opening of the Barron's Hotel in 1971, showing Henry Christopher, dubbed a prominent local investor and businessman, standing next to the mayor, wearing a tuxedo and shaking hands while smiling at the camera. He was young, his resemblance to his future son sharp and distinct. At his shoulder was a cool, pretty blonde woman in a shiny silk dress, smiling tightly at the camera. In true 1971 style, she was listed in the caption only as Mrs. Christopher. Ilsa, Fiona thought. Her name is Ilsa. She stared at the two faces, both young.